This week on Writers, Inc.
So I outline my novels the same way that I would like a screenplay, like a scene-by-scene outline that translates into a sort of chapter-by-chapter outline. And I approach it the same way with that idea of like, okay, what's the dramatic movement of this scene? Who wants what? What are the obstacles? Do they achieve that goal? And how does that organically create the next scene?
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Jenna Brown.
J.P. Reinflesh.
Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I am transmitting remotely from the bar in my house. I got kicked out of my office about 5 minutes ago by the folks at Home Depot. When we bought this place, we had to take this house down to the studs, and we renovated literally everything. And windows are crazy expensive, and this house has a lot of them. So when the contractors went through, you know, we basically had to make a judgment call. If the window looked okay, we left it, and then we replaced the other ones. I think we did 40 windows of the first go around.
Wow.
Everything else in the house is brand new. And like, you know, when you're walking around a brand new house and you see an old window, it starts to get to you after a while.
Yeah.
All those things kind of jump out at you. During the winter, we had cold spots and stuff. Like just, you know, older windows just aren't insulated that well. So we bit the bullet, contacted Home Depot, and they scheduled, you know, an install. They came out, they started yesterday. There's 22 of them now that they're doing. And they've been working their way through the house. And I specifically told them the only time they can't get into my office is between 12 and 2 on Thursday. And he nodded his head, gave me a thumbs up. And then like literally 5 minutes before we're set to record, he's like, can we do this room now? So,
yes,
so
that sounds about right.
Yeah, so I am in the bar, which Christine kind of saw when they came to visit for the book launch, but it was still like drywall and under construction. But now it is all done. Not that you can really
JD's see. Got a broadcast from his bar. The first worldiest of first world problems.
I could take a break and get a drink and play pool behind me. You know.
Yeah. So we'll just see you in the background while we're chatting. You're just like going, grabbing yourself a drink.
Yeah, there we go.
With his robot bartender.
Robot bartender, yep. I used that thing. I tried to use it at the beginning. So for people who haven't heard about this, it's a company called Bartizan, and they make, it's almost like a Keurig for the bar. So you get these tiny little pods. So if you want an old fashioned, you put the pod in there, and it's got these tanks that hold all your various types of liquid. So it knows exactly what to take and how much to put in there. So it's super cool, but like, I'm not a drinker. Like I don't mind a beer every once in a while. My go-to is Angry Orchard. As far as, you know, just regular stuff. And I'll drink like a White Russian. That's probably the drink I order most at restaurants. And this thing doesn't make White Russians. So it is sitting up on the counter. It looks awfully pretty, but it hasn't gotten a whole lot of use.
Doesn't make White Russians.
That's a crime.
It's the specialty ingredients, right? So like I went out and bought the stuff to make it myself. So like I can make a White Russian, I can make a mudslide, and a couple other things that this thing doesn't make. But this will make like pretty much every margarita, every, you know, typical mixed drink under the sun, which it's pretty cool, you know, for somebody like if you don't want to learn how to tend bar, you know, it does the perfect mix every time, which is cool.
And
also just from a waste standpoint, you know, like you don't have to have like all these different ingredients on hand because they're in that pod. You know, so if you're a full-fledged, you know, bar serving people, like it doesn't matter. You know, you have limes on site, you know, you've got lemons, you've got all these different things, but you know, who has that in their house, you know? So
yeah.
Anyway, yeah. For first
the answer is everyone else I'm related to. My entire family has all that stuff all the time.
Yeah.
And JP, I hear there's celebration in order. We're gonna get cake.
Yeah.
Right? What's going on?
So I think it was a couple months ago, I ordered 1,000 books, which is the first time for me ordering that many books. I'm used to doing like, I was originally used to having like 30 on hand in stock. That was like my good number. Then I started doing TikTok shop and things were like, you know, I guess had to do 100 books and then I was selling out in like 2 to 3 weeks. So I was like, okay, I got to get faster. So finally bit the bullet and did 1,000 book order, which was a drastic difference in cost, but it was coming from Poland and it went through customs, which took forever, but I finally got it. 36 boxes. that I had to carry. Half of them are still on our porch, which is an enclosed porch, and then I'm just going through them one by one to make sure there's no bent and dents to report, and then putting them on a shelf and hoping that that shelf will contain most of them, which it won't.
This is the part where most authors lose their garage.
Yeah, right. We don't have one of those.
but you've got a porch,
a tree fell on it, and we got rid of the garage.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we're reconverting our dining room to be like a shipping center, kind of, because we haven't used the dining room in forever. So we just figured, hey, why not? Because I got these, and then I have like 600 more books of a different book, and then I'll just be turning that place into a shipping center.
just put them in your bar.
Yeah,
in the
all
barn
of us have
that
a
I
bar.
Also, don't have.
Move the robot bartender aside to make some room.
Oh,
you don't have to. That's what the pool
the
table
robot
is for.
Bartender
this is
to
pool
yeah.
table. All the packing, right? It can just. It's, I'm
perfect.
Sure.
Stack them near the jukebox.
perfect.
There is a jukebox right over there.
you we know. Well. We all know.
Yeah.
Right. Well, before we get into news, we got some listener feedback from last week when we were talking about Hank Green's Bean app to get you off the phone. Yeah, I don't remember the name of it. Does anybody remember the name of that thing?
I think it was the Bean app.
I don't remember.
Because his Bean is apparently Bean means like some sort of avatar. It's not an actual Bean. It's like because his Bean is a cat.
Yeah.
So I hate this app. I hate whatever it is. I don't want it to exist, but other people seem to like it. But we had a listener named Sam who said that he uses Zen Detox, the phone app that simplifies your phone home screen and enables time reminders for apps. It's free, and I found massively helpful in stopping me opening apps I don't need to look at and kicking me out of apps I spend too much time in. And there is a link, which I think we'll be able to put in our show notes to the Google Play Store anyway.
So, I am still perfectly fine just turning my phone upside down.
Yeah.
That's a fun
baby
trick.
With the superpowers.
It saves batteries, you know, like this.
Yeah.
There are probably a million different apps for this kind of thing. I mean, I know there are for the Mac.
Honestly, the only thing I do is I turn on the iPhone, I turn on the Do Not Disturb feature. And then I go because I don't know, I have at least that much self-discipline. I may not be able to turn away a brownie, but I can definitely turn off notifications.
It's made me a little dependent on other people, but I've found that doing a Zoom call with another writer and then doing like 25-minute sprints is my way of being like, okay, I can't touch anything else because I have to report on what I just did. And so like I have to tell them what I did. They have to tell me what they did. So I get in the zone. I put in some headphones and I go. But that's been the best for me.
That too sounds like a nightmare. all right, let's get into the news. Speaking of nightmares, Anthropic is settling as authors claim to win, quote, historic settlement. Anthropic says it reached a binding term sheet to settle the author class action over training on millions of pirated books. Details are due to the courts in early September, with a hearing around September 8th. The author's lawyer called it a, quote, historic settlement for all class members. The Publishers Association is cautiously optimistic it will be pro-copyright and pro-innovation. Writers can expect formal instructions once terms are filed. Until then, there's nothing to do, but this could become the first major class-wide win against an AI company. Honestly, I'm gonna say I don't like this. I don't like this as an outcome. I think this is problematic. But
why?
I'm kind of surprised.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised too. Yeah.
Well, they touched on this. We talked about it, I guess, a couple of weeks ago, right? Like the actual cost of going to following through on all this if they lose, like it would put them under. And like when I worked in compliance back in the financial industry, like we used to have to settle cases all the time, and we called it nuisance value, because a lot of times, it's either cheaper to just settle a case because of the dollar amount that's at stake, cost you way more or to defend it, or you get into, muddy waters like this where you've got no clue what it's going to actually cost you. But if it can bankrupt the company, like you obviously don't want to roll those dice. So you come up with some kind of number that kind of makes sense for everybody. The reason I don't like this is because it doesn't set any kind of precedence.
Right.
This is not the only suit that's out there. There's a bunch of them. Maybe they're all going to settle, but if that happens, then we still have no case law to actually base, future
Right.
law on. So nothing is really getting settled other than we're all going to get checks for like 13 cents in 4 years.
That's what I was thinking too. It's like I don't know if you guys did it, but I went ahead and went to that website, signed up, and it, it asked for all the books that were included in that thing, and it was every single book I've written, which is, more than 70 titles. Actually, it was closer to 100 titles because there's stuff in there that's no longer in print. So I went ahead and did it, so I may get 13 cents per book, which might add up to
Ooh.
a nice cup of coffee.
Yeah.
All
You're gonna be rolling in it. Nice.
am going to be rolling it. Next up, hundreds of thousands of Grok chats exposed in Google results. This is terrifying. Google indexed about 300,000 Grok chat share links, making private-looking conversations publicly searchable, including passwords, health questions, and illegal how-tos. It's not just Grok. OpenAI and Meta have had shared chats surface in search/public feeds too. Anonymized transcripts can still expose names, locations, health, or business details, and once indexed, they're hard to scrub. Users should assume AI chats are public. Don't paste sensitive info, avoid share links, review privacy settings, and delete shared threads.
And so this is Google searches 2.0, right? Like, 'cause as a writer, like I've got some crazy Google searches. And I've been keeping Claude open on my second monitor in my office because I'm finding that for a lot of questions, it's easier just to ask Claude. Like this morning I asked it, how deep is the Potomac River right in front of the Lincoln Memorial? Like I could figure that out with a couple of Google searches, but Claude tells me right off the bat. But I've got similar searches in there about guns, about weapons, about how to do this, how to do that, all book related. But yeah, like all that stuff is going to get
Fiction.
indexed. Yeah, I mean, this is right. I mean, you've got to assume whatever you type in there is
That's
going to
why I
be
used
public.
a pseudonym the whole time I signed up. I told it, my name is J.D. Barker. Here's the stuff that I want.
Now you're thinking
Where do I
perfect.
bury a body?
Right.
Yeah, I've been using Kevin Tomlinson, so we're all good.
Oh, wow. Look at that. Nice little crossover episode.
Yeah, I mean, they don't have privacy settings, and I think that a lot of people get confused or forget the fact that like this is a company that could easily leak this information and you don't have control over that. It doesn't have any sort of guardrails around that. So it is really concerning when stuff like this, because I know a lot of people use this for like health stuff and for like very personal data, and they sort of forget that the faces behind what they're asking don't really care. It's just data for them.
Well, it's like who reads the terms and conditions,
Nobody.
like
They use
nobody
AI
does.
to summarize it.
And exactly. And there's always something in there that's basically like, well, if push comes to shove, we can probably put all this somewhere. It's the crazy digital world out there, but I don't think that there's much privacy in most like social media, like anything that you're signing up for an account, your email, like none of it's really 100% private. Like Google Docs, it's all.
Oh yeah, they index every word you type into a Google Doc. And anything that flows through Gmail, like none of that is private. And they don't hide from that fact. Like they flat out tell you.
They do, but I think it's sort of like it's buried enough that if you don't really like know, you have the illusion of privacy, you have the illusion of security.
Yeah, this is more problematic because this data, obviously has to be captured for the thing to work, but it's supposed to be behind a, some type of firewall, for from function standpoint. It shouldn't be someplace where it could be searchable by Google. Google is very fast when it comes to searching and indexing, and like what, like the article points out, once it does that, it's there forever. It's part of it. Even if you delete it, it's going to end up in an archive. Like there's no getting away from it.
I think we'll see kind of a solution to this eventually evolve out of, because like I saw Elon Musk post something about edge computing and moving AI to that model. And the idea there is that it's all being done local. So it's kind of like it's a little bit like, here's my understanding of it. And I'm applying a very limited exposure here. So if someone else knows better, feel free to let us know. But one of the examples I kind of came across was the idea that like instead of sending your photo to this cloud server, it sends the data that could reconstruct that photo. And then when you want the app to edit that photo, it does it on your side by sending back the information on how to do that or something along those lines. And I thought, well, that's interesting. It's all sort of client side, which I remember experiments in that back in my engineering days, but that it didn't quite work because the technology wasn't viable.
Well, they're doing that for selfish reasons though, because the storage capabilities on these, for AI is the requirements are insane. So whatever data they can keep on your local drive and off of theirs is better. I'm watching Mission Impossible, the final one right now, and Tom Cruise is all over stopping the AI. So I'm pretty sure he's gonna fix this for everybody. So I'm banking on that.
I
Good.
do think.
Perfect.
Tom Cruise is he seems reliable. I think that
Yeah,
if
100% reliable.
he
Save
came
us
through in
some
every
money.
other movie, so I've got my fingers crossed.
He's definitely not some form of technological clone from the future.
Absolutely not.
And I would
I
not know otherwise. Final story. C-SPAN launches book club series. C-SPAN launches America's Book Club this fall, a weekly primetime series hosted by David M. Rubenstein, with live author interviews taped at iconic sites like the Library of Congress, Folger Shakespeare Library, Enoch Pratt Library, and the National Archives. It's part of the America 250 celebration, aiming to explore ideas that shaped the nation and to nudge viewers to visit libraries and cultural landmarks. Guest lineup includes John Grisham, David Grann, Walter Isaacson, Stacy Schiff, Henry Louis Gates Jr., Amy Coney Barrett, Jose Andre, and Arthur Brooks. Rubenstein's pitch: books demand deep focus. You become a better person by reading. So this show is designed to spark that habit again.
I am all for this.
I am all for it. I just think it's very funny that the channel isn't C-SPAN the one where they just like film Congress and it's just like, if you need to fall asleep, that's what you want.
It's the political equivalent of putting like a fishbowl in your office. So you just turn C-SPAN on. It's like backdrop.
That is just notoriously dull is the one that's going to
That's
reinvigorate
it, though. It's like you're watching the paint drying channel.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that they're doing that. Maybe they finally realized no one's actually watching them for the content. So good for them.
Actually, I'm gonna confess that I end up watching a lot of C-SPAN
Of course you do,
clips.
Kevin.
Well, it gets really interesting, because especially when it's something that I know a little bit about the background of it. But like when they start having the hearings and stuff, man, I will confess also that what I do is wait for it to appear on YouTube so that I can skip ahead, because nobody has the not even the people who are there have the patience to sit through the garbage that they're spewing. But it can get really interesting. It's and contentious.
I'm gonna wait for it to show up on Netflix so I can just stream the whole series at once.
Perfect.
See the
Just
highlights with the voiceover.
I'll just binge it.
You have a story. Share it with the world. Ingram Spark offers everything you need to publish, promote, sell, and print your book. Reach millions of readers worldwide with powerful tools created for independent authors. Get started for free at ingramspark.com/learn more. All right. Well, who we got up this week, JD?
This week, we've got Brian McCauley on. Brian's a screenwriter turned author who has worked on everything from sitcoms to horror. His debut novel, Curse of the Reaper, was named one of the best horror novels of 2022 by Esquire magazine. His latest is called Breathe In, Bleed Out and releases September 2nd. Here he is, Brian McCauley.
Brian,
Hi, Jenna.
I'm so excited to finally talk to you.
I know it's a trip to finally like be in conversation.
Yeah, just moved from Instagram to Zoom and real life in October.
Yes, I can't wait to come visit Vegas for Halloween.
Well, it is a scary city.
Year round.
Year round. But before we get into any of that and all of that and scaries and slashers, For our listeners, let's start at the beginning. How did you start writing?
I was just home recently in New Jersey and I found a box of old journals and notebooks from grade school. And
Amazing.
I found a two-page piece entitled Tremors 3 Graboids Revenge that I wrote as a young lad.
Wow.
So I guess I started in Tremors fan fiction. But yeah,
That
I
makes
grew
sense.
up like loving scary movies and books, the Goosebumps and Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, but definitely horror movies were like the biggest influence that got me writing. And then that's what I went to school for as a screenwriter and worked in Hollywood for many years. Yeah, I've written many Lifetime original movie thrillers, and I wrote for Fuller House for Netflix, and then switched gears to start writing novels and short stories and novellas.
That's so fascinating. I know that I'm probably not the only one, but I'm really interested in the Lifetime to horror novel pipeline. How do we
I
move from
mean,
A to B?
it really like those TV movie thrillers, they have to keep a very fast pace, and because they, actually aired on TV with commercial breaks, you really like every 10 minutes or so have to make sure you've got some kind of cliffhanger to keep people coming back to find out what did that devious nanny do this time.
Always the devious nanny.
Always, they just can't be trusted. And I will say, like, they gave a lot of encouragement around just like embracing the campiness and the fun of it all. So they were very fun to just lean into the twists and turns and also the sort of tongue-in-cheek humor. But yeah, definitely writing kind of chapter ends with cliffhangers, kind of like I feel like writing those TV movies helped with that for sure.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. Learning how to write those natural breaks, which is harder than you would first think. You think, you sit down to write and you're like, oh, this is going to be so easy, but really getting that rhythm.
Yeah, it is like finding that rhythm and flow. I mean, for me, it's a lot in the revisions of trying to tweak those transitions and or rearrange chapters sometimes to find the right energy or flow. But yeah.
Yeah. So, coming from that TV, do you find that you're more a plotter, or do you sort of just go by the seat of your pants? How does that translate to writing books?
I am a big time plotter. So I outline my novels the same way that I would like a screenplay. And so I'll have like a scene by scene outline that translates into a sort of chapter by chapter outline. And I approach it the same way with that idea of like, okay, what's the dramatic movement of this scene? Who wants what? What are the obstacles? Do they achieve that goal? And how does that organically create the next scene? And so I'm very kind of meticulous with my outlining and plotting. My outlines are actually getting longer the more that I write. So they're becoming closer to kind of first time, like short first drafts.
Yeah, draft zero.
Yeah. But then my actual first drafts are also kind of what I call like skeleton drafts, which are the kind of next step of like, okay, now my characters are in scene, I'm hearing their voices. We're moving through the settings, and I just keep it. That's like an iterative process of fleshing it out with each deeper draft. But I think coming from screenwriting, the kind of doing the most economical version first and then getting deeper into the fun of fiction is where I go.
Yeah, it's so funny you say that because everyone I know who plots, myself included, start out with sort of like brief outlines, and then the next one's a little bit longer, and then the next one's a little bit longer, and the next one's a little bit longer, and then soon, your V.E. Schwab describing your outlines is unhinged because they're so detailed.
Yep. I
Yeah.
know. I always like warn my agent because I always have him read my outlines first. So I'm like, so this one's longer than the last one, so buckle in. But I feel like it helps me to feel more confident when I sit down to like a blank page and starting a chapter to
Oh,
like.
for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, then you follow where organic things lead or different directions it might take. Changes happen for sure, but definitely having that structure helps me feel more confident to explore those new avenues that come up.
Yeah. Do you use any, or did you start using any tools? You know, like I know Save the Cat has a lot of sort of like those beats, and then there's I just discovered John Truby, I think
Oh,
his.
yeah.
Yeah, that actually was really helpful for me. Do you follow any of those, or did you start with those and now you've kind of morphed into your own thing?
Yeah, it's kind of that, like I'm a big proponent of reading craft books. I know a lot of writers have different opinions about that. For me, like I just like to geek out and like I know that I'll get at least something from the craft book. I think as long as you don't follow any single kind of formula or structure like religiously, I think that you can find your own path and just kind of, for me, I've like internalized all of those books and structures so that one day my brain might be thinking, like pulling from Mythic Hero's Journey, and another might be Save the Cat. But I think that having all of those different ways to think about story and structure and character has helped me a lot. And yeah, process-wise, I definitely will start with the corkboard and index cards because I'm just thinking, like my first question when I have an idea for a book is, all right, what excites me about this premise is probably a handful of scenes that are kind of baked into the premise. So let's get those up on the board first and then figure out how do I earn those big set pieces in the scenes in between that build the up and down kind of trajectory.
Oh, I love that. Earn those big set pieces. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's I think it was and I should apologize to listeners because I am a screenwriting professor, so I sometimes go into professor mode. But there's a Robert Towne quote who wrote Chinatown, and he said that, you know, if a film is really just four or five great scenes, and your work as a writer is to just make those as powerful as possible with all the work you do in between. And that really kind of resonates with me as writing novels as well.
It reminds me of one of the things I read sort of early on when I was trying to figure out character. Oddly, was an acting book. Ivana, I'm not going to remember her last name, but one of the biggest things I took away from that book was essentially as an actor, you go into it and you have to win the scene, right? Like,
Yes.
so how do you get your characters to always win the scene? So I think between winning the scene and then earn that scene, I really like how those just light bulbs go off. That's great.
Yeah, 'cause for me it's like, and it helps as a teacher too to like always be pointing to like what's the actionable goal? Like that's the driving force of a story and a scene is a character wants something, and the pursuit of that want, I think, is what we as readers and viewers really relate to and attach to, because that's what we do every day. We like pursue wants and
Especially if they
desires.
shouldn't go
Yes,
after what they want.
those are the most fun, as when we get the dramatic irony of like, I see what this character's doing. This isn't going to end well.
Right. Yeah. Pro. No, don't do it. Don't do it. Oh, you're gonna do it. Yeah, exactly. So, you mentioned you're a full-time professor, which I imagine keeps you quite busy. How do you juggle? Like, what does your writing daily writing look like?
Yeah, so for me, like I write best in the mornings. Like first thing, I want to put my like full tank energy into writing. And so I'll usually wake up, you know, 5:30, 6 a.m. every day and try to get in at least 2 hours of writing. And then and then I switch gears to, you know, if I have a 9 a.m. class or meetings, I don't have that weight hanging over me then of like, okay, I have to write today. I have to make sure I make time. And I teach my students that too, of like, find your rhythm, find your the habit that works best for you, and then make it a priority. Maybe you're a night writer, so whatever you have to do to make sure you carve out that time. But for me, I just know that first thing is when I get the best work done, so I just have to kind of protect that time and then switch gears to teaching.
Yeah, I had talked about on a previous show. I've gotten into the habit of I have like a little electric tea kettle, and then I
Yeah.
just like go to sleep with my laptop, like kind of like next to the bed, and so it's just sort of like I don't even have to like really be awake. I can just kind of bleary eye, just like turn the hot water on, grab my laptop, and just sort of like dream right. So.
Yes, I love that. Yeah, I definitely go to bed like thinking about how good that morning coffee is gonna taste. So that's something to look forward to.
Yeah, whatever you got to do. But yeah, it does. It definitely helps to just get that out of the way. And then it kind of starts your creativity all day anyway.
Yeah, I can still be thinking about it later. And depending on my, teaching schedule on a given day, being a professor is not like a 9 to 5 or teaching schedule. So there might be days when I can get more done in the afternoon or the evening. I might go to the bar and write there just to kind of switch up the energy a little.
Yeah. Well, I can't imagine how difficult like Hollywood is, and then becoming a professor is like a different kind of challenging. Traversing the trenches of traditional publishing as its own type of international warfare. What has been the biggest obstacle for writing novels and your publishing and the publishing process?
That's a great question. I mean, I'll say that I was blissfully ignorant of how difficult it was going to be. And I thought, coming from a background of having, produced film and TV credits, I was like, surely, it will be easy for me to just have an agent pick me up. And no, I had to start just like everyone else does, like querying and getting all of the rejections.
All of
My first book, I didn't get an agent when I queried, but I ended up submitting it to an indie press that said they wanted to publish it. But then I took that offer back to the querying and said, I have an offer, and landed an agent to help find to kind of leverage that offer and talk to the company and figure out, like, okay, we'll give you this amount of time to go shop it, and if you don't sell it, we're still here. So it was a very stressful time of like,
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
but yeah, gratefully that first book, Curse the Reaper, was published, and that kind of affirmed for me, like, okay, this is what I want to keep doing. But it was a one book deal, and then it was like, okay, so I have to do this all over again, and we have to hope. But gratefully, I had a request from Shortwave Publishing to pitch something. So I did two novellas for them. And then this new book went out on a submission. And it was again that process of just like, you just need one yes, but you sure do get a lot of no's before that yes.
Sure do. So, did you go back to the rejected agents, or did you have open submissions when you got that
No,
small press?
I actually went back to, I used manuscript wish list, and I, it had been, a month or two, maybe, and so I went back to see if there were any new agents that had appeared since
Yeah.
I had queried, and there was one, that, yeah, I gratefully, I was like, hey, I have this offer, and he read the book over the weekend and was like, it was an offer with no advance with an indie press, like I said, and he was like, I think we can sell this to a bigger publisher, so let's try. So I was like, all right. But yeah, gratefully. And but it the stress of like, is the next book going to sell, like, never goes away. There's no
Yeah.
like broken in done deal kind of thing.
Yeah, I know. And it feels like there should be, especially when you're in the querying trenches, like that very first time, you know, I know there's like this impulse to be like, I just need to get an agent. I just need to get an agent. And then I'll have made it. And it's like, well, and then you have to just go on submission. And then you go on submission. And then you have to just go on submission.
There was a point with Breathe and Bleed Out that, my agent and I had the conversation where I was like, is it effectively dead on submission at this point? And he was like, I think it is. I think we have to accept that, like, there was a big five editor who loved it but couldn't convince the whole team. So they were saying, maybe we can develop something together. So I was starting that process of like, okay, I wrote a whole ass book that didn't sell, and now I have to start over. But gratefully, then we heard back from a publisher that hadn't responded yet, and it was Poison Pen. And it was like, couldn't have been a more perfect fit when I spoke to my editor, Rachel, and she just understood exactly what the book was and where she saw it in the marketplace. And it was like a big relief on that front.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, well, it's a great book.
Oh,
And I
thank you.
do want to talk about it, but I to transition a little bit more gracefully. You write slashers, obviously, and slashers, typically people I think associate them with film. But the literary slasher is making quite a splash in recent days. Why do you think readers are suddenly sort of like really into that written slasher form.
You know, it's fascinating to me, and I don't know that I've figured out. I mean, I know for me why. Like, I grew up on those movies. Like, Scream introduced me, like, opened the door backwards towards all the 80s franchises, and I grew up on them and loved them. And so it makes sense to me, because I'm just like, well, yeah, because slashers fucking rule. What other reason do
Right.
we need? But I'm seeing,
Obviously.
like, when I read, like, early reviews of my book, and there have been a lot of readers who are like, I didn't think I liked slashers, but after reading this, I think maybe I do. And that's, like, the coolest feeling of opening that door for a new reader to see, like, it's not that far off from, a thriller. Like, I have a long author's note in this book talking about, like, the origin of the slashers and my love for it. And one of the things I noted was, like, looking at, like, Agatha Christie one by one, and then there were none murder mysteries. Like, that setup is what the slasher is. But I think the biggest difference is that in the slasher, in the thrillers, you usually people, like, find dead bodies. In the slasher, you're gonna watch them be torn to
Be
bits and slashed.
unalive.
It's like, yeah, exactly. But I think, obviously there's a huge kind of nostalgia kick in genre right now, from the Stranger Things of it all to now the, reboots of Scream, and I Know What You Did Last Summer and all of that. So I think nostalgia is part of it. But I also just think a kind of grounded horror movie, it resonates in that way that just feels very real and very scary for people. And that the book version, to me, like, you can just go so much deeper. I think that slashers are in film have so many kind of stereotypes and tropes that then in the book you get to go inside character psychologies and add a little bit more depth than you can in the film version.
Yeah, it works surprisingly well. Like when you first hear about it, you think like you can't put a splash. How do you do a jump scare? But it does translate.
Yeah,
Well.
it definitely requires some, I think the first book that opened me to it was, There's Someone in Your House by Stephanie Perkins. And the way that she did that craft wise, I was like, okay, that's how you do it. You can do a chapter from the point of view of a soon to be victim. And just, it's the same way you would in a movie, that the camera is now over here with this other character, and then we can return to our protagonist. And that, from a craft perspective, is super exciting and fun as well, because you get to play in different voices and go deeper into different characters, and you don't have to just stay in one limited POV.
Right. Yeah. So where did you get the idea for breathe in, bleed out? Where did this little monstrosity come from?
I mean, I lived in Los Angeles for a decade, so I definitely had many brushes with kind of wellness culture. And it really started with the idea of the setting of a wellness, like, healing retreat, and the idea, like, there are these kind of sets built into it of sound bath and yoga and hot springs and all of that. Like, to me, was such a great setting to say, okay, then let's throw a psycho killer in the mix and let them.
Then let's turn them into murder weapons.
Yeah, that's how everybody thinks, right? So it really did, like, start with that, and then I reverse engineered from there, like, okay, but what's the story? Who's the character? And the obvious answer was, like, well, it's a healing retreat, so it needs to be somebody who has something they need to heal from. And that's where the start of developing Hannah's character came from, and realizing that, okay, I'm going to start with a character who has already kind of survived her own kind of harrowing final girl journey, and then is starting this new journey already messed up and not doing great, and make it a little bit better for her before I make it a lot worse. And then be able to play with an unreliable narrator through that. So it was a lot to juggle, because it was also my first time writing a proper murder mystery, and the kind of aspects of that plot to track and build were also required a lot of kind of plotting. But super fun to do so and build them around lots of gory set pieces.
Lots of gory set pieces. That was actually one of my favorite things about the book. I mean, there's a lot to love, but you were quite inventive with the death in this
Yes.
and I thought it would be fun to talk about that a little bit, you know, because that's not easy to think of how to kill someone with fun and aplomb,
Yeah.
right? Like, without coming across as cliche. Like, so talk to us about your inventive death, Brian.
It requires a lot of practice on the page, to be
On
clear.
the
And it, no, it, I think that that's another aspect, you know, compared to like film where there's no constraints of budget or worrying like, all right, is this going to be practical effects or do we need to do CGI? Because how are we going to pull this off and make it look
Right.
realistic? And the fun of fiction is that your reader is having to fill in those blanks and to participate in the construction of this gory set piece in their brain. So trying to find that balance, I think, is the fun of giving just enough detail, you know, the physical elements, the sound design of it, and also like playing with metaphors. There's, yeah, that to me is kind of the really, really where like the craft element of fiction I have the most fun with, of like, okay, how much detail can I get into here without, you know, tipping it so far that I'm again not allowing the reader to add enough elements into it. So yeah, I definitely, that's always a goal with every book I write, is like, I don't like to write slashers where someone's just stabbing everybody. Like, there's nothing fun to elaborate on there. So I need to extrapolate further. And usually, like I said, that iterative process, the death in the outline usually gets more elaborate when I'm actually drafting it. I'm like, oh, I could take this one step further.
Just add a little bit and
Yeah.
add a little bit. No, I think I've read everything you've written, and I do have to say, you do not just stab, stab, stab. They're very it's inventive stabbing. It's very inventive.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, like the Final Destination franchise is one that I was raised on, and that was always part of the fun, and that's the goal. I'm sure there are some listeners who are like, fun and gruesome murder, is that a combination we're embracing? Because I am. I think that that's the fun of horror movies that can translate into books, is that like a laugh and a gasp are kind of entwined in like, this is just so much or so over the top and so crazy that it also feels more safe that way, but it's still scary. But I think finding that balance is part of the fun.
Yeah, 100%. So, you've had quite a long career and a couple different approaches. What's been the biggest surprise over the course of your career so far?
I think the biggest and best surprise is the community that I've found in, once I started writing novels and short stories and everything, was, you know, writing is such a solitary experience. And in screenwriting, like, yes, there were opportunities where I got to go to set, or, you know, for Fuller House, we worked on the Warner Brothers lot and shot with a live studio audience, and I was in the writer's room. So there was a sense of community there. But I think in fiction writing, there's this beautiful thing of like, I get to put my heart on the page, hand it to a stranger, and if they connect with it, then there's this instant kind of bond of like, okay, cool, you've thought or felt or enjoyed these things too. And there are so many now. I think the horror genre is doing so many exciting things and opening up to so many more diverse voices that it's just growing and growing. And so many events popping up where people get to actually interact. And that's been such a wonderful surprise to see, you know, we're all the weirdos in the towns we grew up in. And
Yeah.
so now the internet has provided a way to connect with people and to make friends through like Instagram, who then build into friends where you're like, okay, cool. It started online and now we get to hang out in person. And for all of that to be built around books is just like, that's the best.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is really cool. Well, as you know, we always like to close out the show with one final question, which is, what is one piece of advice you would give to new or aspiring writers?
I, with the caveat that I would say, find whatever process works for you. But I think as if you're starting out, my biggest piece of advice would be just to get through that first draft without looking back, and to try to get it down as quickly as you can without judging your words. And just, I think that a lot of writers get stuck at maybe getting a certain point into a book or a story, stopping, reading it back, convincing themselves it's shit, and then giving up. And I think if you have something that's complete, if you have something that's like, okay, the story is written, the book is complete, now I can see the whole thing, and now the real work of revising and making it better begins. For me, that at least instills a sense of like confidence to like, okay, it exists. Now my job is to fix it. So yeah, I would say just finish the thing. Don't look back. Don't judge yourself.
I love it. Finish the thing. Thank you so much for coming
Thank
on
you
the show
so
today.
much.
This was so much fun.
It was an absolute treat. Thank you so much
Yeah.
for having
And
me.
if anyone out there really likes inventive, gory, fun mayhem, pick up Brian's books. You'll have a great time.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this chat, so thank you for having me.
It's probably pretty obvious. I had a great time during this interview. Brian is so much fun to talk to. And I love the Lifetime to horror pipeline.
Fuller House. I think
I,
that would set up
yeah.
anybody for writing horror.
Fuller House and Bloody House.
See, yeah. But I really liked that it was sort of like kind of teaching about, like I never really kind of thought about those made for TV movies where you have to have something that brings people from the commercial break and sort of to use that to function like with chapter breaks.
Oh yeah.
It was really interesting. You guys do a lot of that with like the chapter. How do you kind of keep those pages turning, like, with those commercial bits?
One of the things I learned early on, especially when writing thrillers, is I go back and delete something. So like your mind, when you write a chapter, it's looking for a beginning, middle, and like your brain basically creates some kind of closure at the end of that chapter. But when you're writing a thriller, that's not what you want. You don't want to end it. You want the reader to have to turn that page in order to get to the next part. So one of the first steps I always do when I go through a draft is I take, a lot of times the last sentence, the last paragraph out of every chapter, either delete it completely, because a lot of times it doesn't even need to be there, or I'll move it to the start of the next chapter, but something that forces it to end on a cliffhanger.
Yeah, that's the same thing really. I use the same approach that I use in like good marketing copy, and it's that open loop process. You're creating. It's the same thing JD's talking about really. There's a you've hinted at something, you've left out a key piece of information, and they read on thinking, even if they only register subconsciously, thinking that they'll close that loop in the next scene. Not knowing that you just keep looping until they get to the end of the book.
I do think that's interesting. I wonder, but how you do that too, how you know what the thing, because there's sometimes you see people try to do that in writing and it's they leave the wrong thing out. Does that make sense? How
That's
do you
called practice.
practice?
It
I think
almost doesn't
too.
matter. Honestly, any like logical loop that you start but don't complete is it's almost always enough. And maybe you're leaving the wrong thing out if the idea is you're trying to progress the story, on that point. But like for example, like I just finished a chapter in one of my new Kotler books, and this bit had nothing to do with the main story. He's investigating something. He goes and he talks to some people. He finds out he needs to go to this like storage facility. But the loop I ended on was that he checked his phone and he had forgotten to return a call to his girlfriend back in New York. And he knew there would be trouble. And that's it. That's the open loop. But it's enough to keep them, people are interested. They want to know what's going on in the storage unit, but the thing that they're, going to turn the page for us to find out whether he got reamed out by his girlfriend girlfriend over the phone.
Yeah.
That's a really good one because you can call it back a couple of times.
Yeah.
Anytime he picks up his phone, you could drop a little something to reference it and make it that much more, build it up.
Right.
Yeah. And like the concept of getting through a story and like this thriller aspect is also applicable to other genres as well. As someone who writes cozy fantasy, I often I write cinematically, where I try to keep the reader sort of in a bingeable aspect of it, or try to like get them to want to read the next thing. Especially because I had originally written a serial, so you sort of have this idea that you want people to keep reading, keep coming back every week.
Yeah.
And so there's just I really liked the one thing he talked about of like the five scenes you write towards, which I always view those as like the pillars of the story that I'm like I have these scenes and these events in between, but everything leads up to this next pillar, and then I go to the next one, and then I go to the next one. But I really liked that reflection and screenwriting was sort of similar because I feel like a lot of my writing relates towards that cinematic view.
Yeah, I do think that's kind of important. Like Kevin just said, like you can use those other little threads to like sort of keep some of that tension and stuff going. But as long as you're heading towards like those main points of your story, I think that also keeps the reader like invested and on track, so it's not too much of a deviation. I like
No,
that.
honestly, the other thing you have to be careful of is you need to make sure you actually close those all out at some point because
Oh,
somebody's
yeah.
going to be thinking about them through that whole book. And I typically keep a list in front of me of anytime I open a thread until I close it out, I leave it on that list. But something I tried with this latest book, I just finished a book up yesterday. I dropped the entire thing into Claude and asked it, did I leave any open threads? And it
Oh,
gave me a couple that I missed. Read that whole book. It was 96,000 words, in a couple seconds, and gave me a working list. So I think that, and from an AI standpoint, that's definitely a use I'm comfortable with because it's so easy to make that kind of mistake and forget
Oh
about some
yeah.
little minor thing,
Yeah,
Yeah.
there's nothing worse than getting back from like, your alpha and your beta readers, like, what happened with this? And you're like,
Well,
yep.
that's the thing, right? In today's world, if you're not doing like the AI thing, it will probably get caught. If you're smart enough to have alpha and beta readers, or possibly editors or somebody down the line might pick it up, but it could still slip through. But this literally caught everything. So I think it even caught. I had a character where I spelled her name differently. I reversed two letters like halfway through the book and didn't even catch it, and it pointed that out to me. I was impressed.
One thing I like that I learned from Mary Robinette Kowal was the mice quotient, which is this idea that like these events or these loops that you open are broken into four quadrants, which is like milieu, I can't remember all of them, but like character, event, etc. And the way in which she views opening and closing threads is sort of like coding, where in coding you'll have the first thing you open and then a subsect of what you open next, and the idea is when you go to close out the story or close out the code, you have to work backwards. So what you had closed out second is the thing that you then close out. And so by the end of the story, you've answered the first question that you've asked. Now, of course, that isn't always the case, but there's sort of this idea that it's sort of this mirroring effect of what threads you close out to make the reader feel satisfied. Yeah, I like that.
That's very similar to because I stole a lot of ideas from the comic book writing world, and that's a process that they use is this. There's an A, B, C, D, E story, and they're thinking in terms of ongoing series. So, when you complete one, when you complete the A story, the B story takes over, and then it becomes A, and then the C story becomes B, and you're always kind of evolving the story that way.
That's really
Ooh.
smart for a series,
Yeah.
especially. That's really hard to evolve it without getting bored.
What it does, though, is make series easier to pick up from the middle. Because what you've got is completed storylines, and they may come in at the tag end of a story that's dangling from the previous, five books, but it'll almost disappear to them because that resolution is lighter than the sort of complications and resolution of the new A, B, and C story. You get a complete story arc within the book, but there's a this ongoing thread that just makes the world feel richer and more detailed, and will prompt them to go read the other books, but they don't have to read them in order to understand the current story.
Yeah, I like that. I did like if you like slashers, this is such a fun book to read. The Inventive Deaths, like they are very graphic and very gory, but so creative. And I just wanted to ask you, I don't know if you have creative deaths in your cozy fantasy, JP, but what's the most creative death you've
So
ever
gory.
written?
I think you need to add those.
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah.
Before we jump in, I did once have a review that someone complained that my cozy fantasy didn't have a dead body in it. Because they thought cozy mystery, so they got confused, but it was really funny to read.
Oh. All right, I get it. That kind of actually makes sense.
I'm going to write choose your own cozy mysteries. And that way you're the body, right?
You're the body.
Interesting.
I mean, I've killed people in a million different ways. When I
Fictional,
was a kid,
fictionally.
yeah, fictionally. When I
Oh,
was a
yeah,
kid,
right. Yeah, fictionally.
I read a bunch of the Friday the 13th companion novels. And I don't know if you've ever read one of those, but it's really interesting because they actually write portions of it from Jason's point of view. So
Oh,
you get to know what's
interesting.
going on in his head while he's wandering around these camps chasing all the counselors. Even Jaws, if you've never read the original Jaws, like Peter Benchley gets into the shark's head, which is interesting. But yeah, I mean, like any one of those things, like he had mentioned, just jumping back and forth and being able to, go into the POV of the killer, go into the POV of the victim, and then jump back into another head. I think when that's done properly, it's like music.
It's really fun.
I actually wrote a short story that I need to dust off, clean up, get back out there, and see if I can get it some traction. But it was The Man Who Murdered Himself was the title. And the scenario was that he had a business partner who used remote technology, or basically set it up so that when this guy unlocked his alarm code and went inside, it set off a series of like Rube Goldberg like things, so that when he opened his bedroom door, he gets shot by a shotgun. But then all the things that made that happen end up disappearing through means I won't explain, so that you will go read the story. So, but they by all evidence, it looks as if he was shot from inside the room, but there's no weapon, there's nothing to tie, to
Interesting.
call back. But so there's a locked door mystery, but I came at it from the
Pretty
outside.
inventive. Yeah. A
I really
man.
love the like Rube Goldberg style deaths, like in Final Destination. And there was this show called Dead Like Me where the main characters were like reapers and they had to sort of guess who was going to die based off of all the events around them. I love those weird styles of deaths.
I do miss that show. That's a
I
great
don't
show. That was a
remember
good
if we
one.
talked about it, but I know that Final Destination, like that was, it influenced.
Yeah, to this day, I won't drive behind anything hauling pipes or logs.
Yeah, absolutely
I
not.
do.
No way.
There's a new one that's pretty good. Final
Yeah.
Destination Bloodlines.
Bloodlines, yeah.
Yeah.
For it being a Final Destination movie, I had a really good time. Definitely better than some of the ones that are in between.
I mean, I
Right.
saw the first one. I've never seen any of the sequels. So, because it's
The log
supposed to be
one was
Final
two.
Destination,
The
not.
log one was Final Destination 2.
So I may have seen that one, yeah.
Ooh,
And that was a
Kevin.
long time ago, right?
Yeah,
Was
that
it
was forever ago, yeah.
90s
That
is
was
that
a long
one?
time ago. How many of them are there now?
Six.
I thought six, yeah.
Now we're on the final. No, really, we mean it, Final Destination.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's final and then there's final.
Sponsored by the Rolling Stones final tour.
Yeah. Well, we should probably go ahead and wrap up. JD, who we got coming up next week?
This should be a fun one. How many of you are using Substack? I know
Oh,
Kevin's
I
on
am.
Substack. Anybody
Yeah.
else?
Not me.
All
I
right.
thought about it, but not
Well,
me.
you will be.
Yeah, next week we have their head of writer relations on to tell us all about the platform and explore ways we can use it to further the author business. So if you're a current user of Substack or you're considering joining the platform, you won't want to miss it.
Well, if you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.
giving all we've got. But a word comes out sideways, a sentence goes long. Now the draft of our podcast needs a rewrite song. Sorry, Alex, cut that part. It was brilliant in my head, but clumsy from the start. Sorry, Alex, fix my take. It's the Writer's Ink Podcast, mistakes we gladly make. We're plotters and pantsers chasing the muse, but live on a mic, there's no backspace to use. So we stumble through grammar, misquote Twain or King, and hope our brave editor makes it all sing. Sorry, Alex, mark that line. Much better after your edit shines. Sorry, Alex, do your art. You're the unsung hero making podcasts smart. Like a draft on the page, it needs polish and care. Every cut, every trim shows your hand working there. We're the writers with ink. You're the ink with the pen. When we mess it up once, you can make it right again. Sorry, Alex, here we go. Author life's messy, but we want you to know. Sorry, Alex, you're the key.